This is the January 30th statutory interpretation class, and we were just discussing what surprised us about Justice Sotomayor besides her appearance.
But she was so personable.
Yeah.
She was on my shoulders.
All right. Despite that, you still have to shower at some point.
She has complete disregard for all time constraints.
That is also true. I assume that also applied to the other events during the day as well?
I only went to the day of the thing first.
Yeah. I agree, but I think that comes with lifetime appointment and omnipotent power. Yeah. any others?
Okay. I don't know, she just felt like a mentor whenever she was talking. It felt like I knew her, even though I didn't really know her.
Yeah. I mean, by the time she was done, I wanted to be her clerk. Okay, well, I can assure you we will do our utmost to bring other justices down. But I should also just sadly tell you, it may be a decade or two. So treasure the experience while you had it. The only thing I would offer that surprised me about Justice Sotomayor is one, she's much better at this. I saw her when she was first elevated to the bench. She came to Houston to the Progressive Forum to give a speech. And she is so much sharper and so much more at ease than she was back then. Second, I would have never ever guessed that her favorite book was Lord of the Flies. What a dark thing to say.
Right.
Especially since, let's be honest with ourselves, the most lawyer-like character in the book is Piggy. I know, and think what happened to him. All right, I'll stop. Now let's actually get to substance. Anything else? Okay. So, as always, what I'd like to do at the beginning of every class is look back. Now, normally, I try and distill down the pith and give you a few things to take away, but we covered a lot of ground last week, especially on Thursday. So what I'd like to do is essentially beg your indulgence and do a very quick walkthrough of the key things on the legislative process that I would want you to know in your heart if you were going to be advocating for a legislative strategy for a client, or if you were trying to interpret a statute against the background of legislative procedure. So this will sound familiar. This will not be Q&A. This is going to sound like an auctioneer, but I'll run through it real quickly with you. So hopefully this is all sound familiar. Number one, we're going to do it just like with the Civil Rights Act. The House process begins with introduction of the bill, referral to the committee by the speaker, then subcommittees, hearings, markups, and the committee report. All familiar. Ding. Number two, it gets out of the committees. It goes then to the House Rules Committee. Remember, the secret body that most citizens don't know about but has enormous power. The House Rules Committee can come up with either an open rule, which allows all sorts of germane amendments, or a closed rule, which can dictate how the rule is debated, what time is allowed, what type of amendments are offered. It's basically a hand-tailored, what's the word for artisan? Like a bar cocktail, but anyway. Most rules are closed. I didn't know if that came up in our discussion. I want to give you a heads up about that. So then it gets out of the House Rules Committee. Then it gets to, by the way, side note, the House can suspend the rules and directly consider it without a rule, but nonetheless, usually you have a rule. Then it gets a debate on the rule on the House floor. Once the debate on the rule is concluded, then you have a vote on the bill itself. And then once that vote's done, it goes to the other chamber. Very quickly, those are the key things. Any questions about those? Anything that I missed that you think is important enough to add to our short list? Because now we go to the dark, august, mysterious regions of the Senate. Senate works differently. Number one, the bill is introduced, it's referred to the committee by the parliamentarian. Then the Senate hearing takes place. There's a markup just like at the House. Then there's a committee report just like the House. And the leadership can bypass the committee and send it straight to the floor, just like the House. Here, though, is where the paths go different. No rules committee. Remember that. As a result, there is no calendar committee. There is no special rule. There is no germaneness requirement. Instead, you have to have unanimous consent
on debate of the rule. All you need is one senator, one Bernie Sanders, one Ted Cruz to gum up the works. If it's filibuster, then you need to have some type of either process to break the filibuster. Usually that means a cloture motion. Cloture motions are going to require that you need 60 votes to pass them. Not 67, ignore your Civil Rights Act discussion, it's now currently 60. It is not now required for nominees to the judicial bench, courtesy of the nuclear option, which I'll discuss with you in a little bit more detail later in class. Also, it means that you can have 16 signatures to get a cloture motion. You don't need 60 to get cloture started. You just need 60 to get it passed. What does that mean? You can have cloture after cloture after cloture after cloture. They can all get voted down, but you can keep pushing to close off the debate. Once it passes, though, here's where it's important. People screw up, remember? You have to have your germane amendments, it must be germane, filed before the cloture is passed. If you wait till after, you're screwed, to use a legal term. All right? 30 hours typically for debate, and then it gets out of the Senate, presumably. All hanging together, we've got the two halves smashed together. If the two bills are not identical, shunk, off to off to the conference committee. Conference committee basically is where the two sides hammer it out. Key things about that, usually the conference committee is composed of the leading actors in both chambers on that legislation. Typically the chairs of the committee they're referred to, or the subcommittee chairs. The key thing there is you have to have a majority of each chamber's members to get it out of the committee. So you can have a majority of the committee overall wanting it to get out. Doesn't matter. You have to have a majority of each chamber. So watch out, the math gets tricky sometimes. Now, it's powerful, it's the last stop, it's the gateway to making something law, but it has limits. The conference committee cannot make up stuff. They have to use what's in the bills. They can then, unless there's a special direction or rule provided by other chamber. So as a result, they have to stick with the bills, they have to harmonize them and come up with their own language, but they can't add other brand new stuff. And then it has to be passed out and passed by each chamber as it is, usually up or down. No amendments, no changes, otherwise you go back to conference. All clear so far? Okay, then last, not least, the White House. The president signs. Usually that's sort of viewed as almost anticlimactic, but there are still tweaks and twists. Watch out for it, we will talk about later in the semester. The president doesn't just have to pick up the pen and sign. He or she can also put a signing statement on top of it. Signing statements legally have no binding effect. They're not part of the law. They are not an instrument of the federal government with a legally creative effect. Bottom line, though, is that it does encapsulate what the president's interpretation of that statute is. And the president is an actor in the creation of that law, just as much as Congress. And presidents have been pushing hard to basically lay the landmines they want to lay to make the courts interpret the laws the way they want to. So you can have Congress pass language that is intentionally vague and mysterious, contradictory and ambiguous, with the idea that they can then let the courts decide, and the legislature and the executive are both wrestling on shaping what the court will use to make that decision. It all sounds a bit Machiavellian. The key thing for you guys as lawyers is that does create a certain skepticism and cynicism about legislative histories if you're a judge. Because you know someone's trying to reach through to the future to manipulate their decision. All right. I think that is about it in terms of standard legislative process. It's a little bit longer recap than usual. Any questions? All right, so we could actually do a model congressional session here and you guys can push it through. All right, now we get to a little bit of a slowdown. I'm gonna include some recap but also pick up. We finished our last class on Thursday on unorthodox lawmaking. And in a way, it's almost becoming orthodox lawmaking because of the encumbrances in the process. Congress is increasingly turning to to weird ways to pass laws because it's the only way to navigate the filibuster and other procedural impediments. So the question for you is, how do you as a lawyer steer through unorthodox processes to get your client's work done? Alternatively, how do you as a lawyer argue the way a statute should be interpreted when it's passed in a way that may have zero legislative history or may appear ex nihilo from a closed-door conference session? The only way to do that is to try and understand why you take that alternative route and what sorts of factors and other sources of information you can draw on. So all that sounds abstract and bloodless, kind of depressing. Turn it into something real. DACA. Think about what's happening right now with DACA. And here, I'll pause here. This is not the reading. I'm just counting on you being well-informed citizens despite the fact you're in law school right now and are focusing on your readings, I know. But who can just give me a quick summary of where we stand with DACA? And I'm sorry?
Emily.
Oh, that's right, Emily. I'm sorry. So you get the swag for today?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, you can wait.
All right, this is something from Piedras Negras. It is a small Mexican figurine. It says essentially in Spanish on top, "Help me, lawyer." And it has a Day of the Dead figure in prison garb, and the lawyer is a tall, suited raven. Legislatively, what's happened recently?
So legislatively, they were trying to pass the budget, and the Democrats were not going to pass the budget without some concessions from the Republicans on immigration. And so eventually, the Democrats came and decided to end.
By the way, we're taking notes. There's a value judgment built into that one.
Yeah.
Okay. As opposed to tactically retreated or extracted valuable concessions, saying, "Hey."
Okay. And they agreed to end the government shutdown in exchange for a promise that they will consider DACA and immigration that they will agree to hear it.
But absolutely. And if I could pause there, because now we're getting close to now, and the details start to get more important. Who promised?
I believe it was Mitch McConnell.
Right. Our majority leader in the Senate.
But,
oh.
All right.
You baited me. I didn't even mention the State of the Union address tonight.
So
I would suggest.
At the end of the tunnel with Kennedy after.
Not to be a bad citizen, but spend your time watching the lunar eclipse than the president. Anyway, keep going. I'm sorry.
So now, in order for this, for DACA to be passed, they agreed that they will give a path to citizenship for the 1.8 million. Eligible for DACA in exchange for reducing the amount of legal immigration almost by half.
Well, have they agreed to that already?
Well, that's the proposed plan, is that the Republicans are saying that they will grant a path to citizenship, which is even farther than Barack Obama got, but that in order for them to consider that, they're going to have to reduce the amount of legal immigration by almost half.
Okay. So, all true, all passionate, all things that matter. I'd be curious, how many of you know someone who's in the DACA program? Yeah, I mean, it affects us. I have friends that says, well, it's just, let's put that aside now. Why are we in this odd position? It's all legislative mechanics. This was a filibuster. It was a filibuster and a type of legislation that only could be passed up to the 60 supermajority requirement. And I'm going to talk about ways to get around that first. Second, the way it got solved was an informal agreement to put it onto the floor from the Senate Majority Leader, and the terms based on his statement on the floor, and Emily, correct me, you may know this better than I do. A bill, for those listening to the audio, I'm making vigorous air quotes right now. Which bill, undefined, shall be related to the floor for discussion and will be given a level field, quote unquote. Notice, nothing about to what extent the bill may include things that are non-starters for the Democrats. Nothing about whether or not this bill is going to be still subject to filibuster, but from the other side. McConnell does not control, in theory, the entire party that he represents. We all know that. So to a certain extent, I point this out to you in that the legislative mechanics, first of all, pushed us into an opposition where we shut down the federal government because we were unable to reach any kind of majority vote on an issue. And here's the key predicate I want you to have in mind when we talk about the other twists and turns here. This bill would pass a majority vote. It has bipartisan support. I think maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe it's now become so enmeshed with other politics that that's not true anymore. But if it was a clean, straight-up bill, and people voted according to their prior representations, this bill would pass. So all we're talking about right now is the way legislative process impedes or diverts or twists or creates new strategies that you as an advocate can take advantage of or try and counter. So with that in mind, we've just talked about the Senate. We've just talked about the filibuster possibilities. Indulge me in one other fantasy. And this is one I want to point out to you because the book doesn't talk about it. I want to predict to you it's going to become increasingly important. What happens if, against all expectations, the divine occurs? There is a debate in the Senate floor. There is a clean DACA bill referred for consideration, and it surpasses a vote, even a 60-vote margin, and is now out of the Senate. Now, you all guys know what happened next, right? I mean, this is so easy, there's no swag involved. Yes, Drew?
Goes to the House and then they vote no.
Why would they vote no? I just told you it's a majority vote.
Right, but I mean, in the House, I don't know if the numbers are the same as they are in the Senate as far as prior representations and support
done. All right, I will give you that there is a majority, in theory, of House members who would vote in favor of DACA.
Okay, then potentially maybe Paul Ryan would have taken, or he might, he would have to send it through the
All right. Not to make a political comment, but assume Paul Ryan has a spine at that particular moment. And he has said that he is in favor of a path to citizenship for these kids. So, it's still, I agree with you, with your conclusion, but there is a mysterious parliamentary step here that I want to put to you because it is something you need to know. The Hastert rule. Are you familiar with the Hastert rule? Drew, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, the Hastert rule is when you don't put a bill on the floor unless you have a majority of your own party that supports it.
Okay, so here we may have 300 votes, let's put it this way. We have more than enough to pass the majority of the House, but not a majority of the Republican Party, which is probably true, in which case Ryan will bury this law that by majority people would vote for dead. Now, notice I have given you a misleading label. It isn't a rule. This is not a formal statement of the House Rules Committee or any type of House parliamentary procedures. Bottom line is that the Hastert rule is essentially a custom. The Speaker has adhered to it really since Newt Gingrich, not Hastert. And the bottom line here is the Speaker can disregard it. The main reason the Hastert rule has continuing sway is twofold. Number one, it gives the Speaker enormous power. Basically, he is elected by his party. So by reflecting that he will only do what his party wants, even if it isn't what the majority overall wants, makes him more supportable as a majority, as a House Speaker candidate. And number two, people who push to try and get a vote instead of not in counterance to the Hastert rule face possibilities of retaliation. So, I'm sorry, I thought a hand go up, you were just scratching your head. Never mind. Okay. Sorry, John, I didn't mean to pounce on you. Okay. So, is that clear for everybody? Think of the Hastert rule as sort of a cousin, slightly misshapen and dwarfish to the House, to the Senate filibuster. It can have enormous impact in frustrating legislation, and it is another major driver for these alternative paths to lawmaking, and we're going to talk about that. And here, this is going to be a bit of a review, but I just want to make sure it is fixed. And I will be honest with you, this is the sort of thing that I feel honor-bound as your professor to include at least some of this in the final exam, because I really, 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 really think you need to know it. Ways to get around frustrations and blocks in the legislative process. Number one, omnibus legislation. I mentioned this last week, it bears emphasis. This is becoming increasingly the preferred tactic to get legislation passed. You lash everybody together, and if you get enough to get critical mass, you can sometimes get the bill through the process. Number two, pre-baking, backroom deals. Essentially, have all the key constituents of the deal process get together off campus in a closed room with no record and hammer out the details and then essentially present a fully formed legislative package to the membership and say, take it or leave it. We've already struck an agreement. You cannot undeal this deal. We need to move ahead with it. And essentially, you step outside the legislative process and then bring in the final product without creating a legislative history, opportunities for amendments, any type of floor speeches. It's effective, but it creates challenges for us as lawyers, judges, and advocates. Unless, of course, you have access to that secret room. And then third, this is the one which is becoming increasingly important, you can actually regulate the filibuster and choke points by statute. And there's an entire new field of law rapidly developing where Congress is essentially writing laws to govern itself on the process it uses to pass laws. For example, budget reconciliation. Congress has passed legislation, Budget Act of 1974, which essentially gives it the capacity to pass legislation by joint resolution for only a majority vote. No filibuster allowed by statute. Now, it still requires presidential signature, doesn't it? So we don't have all the Chadha issues. I have a very important statement to make here. I am not going to tread as much as I can into the domain of constitutional law because you have a fantastic professor doing con law with you already. So if Professor Rafe says anything to you about constitutional law that differs from what I say, he's right. And I will also, I've talked with him, you know, for example, I will not go into depth with the Chadha decision because I assume you guys will be going to that in your class as well. So I'm sorry, I interrupted. You were going to say something.
Yeah, but it was going to be about, I was just going to ask, is this kind of the issue that Trump addressed in his signing statements on the Russian sanctions and then it sort of became relevant today where Congress put in the statute like a 12-day Congress were to demand like implementation of sanctions somewhere in the statute and said like by a joint resolution and then the president couldn't lift them for 12 days. Is that this domain but just further reaching for Congress making those kind of rules?
Sure, I have a two-layer answer for you. First is I don't know that specific legislation, so take what I'm about to say with a fairly large grain of salt. But it does, level two, sound like exactly what we're talking about, where there is a statutory framework in place that cabins the ability of the way Congress will pass subsequent legislation and also restricts what the executive can do in light of that, which is the second part of our conversation today. Yes?
I'm sorry, what was the first way you said that to get around the
First of all, never have to say you're sorry. That's, you know, if I said something and you need to get clarification of it, that's my bad, not yours. But omnibus. Right. so that everyone lashes themselves to the same mast. All right? Any others? I'm sorry. Got it. You're my field edition.
Hastert.
Dennis Hastert. H-A-S-T-E-R-T. He was a speaker of the House whose largest claim to fame now is that he was subsequently convicted for molestation of children on his wrestling team as a high school coach. So it's rather odd that this is the rule that's keeping us from passing. Anyway, I'm sorry. It's still a rule, regardless of who originally passed it.
A majority of the majority.
So you've got to get over 50% of the Republicans to even get the House to consider it. Worse rival, you know, pass it to a committee.
Thank you.
Sure. That's not the only example. And here's another one that we will probably end up talking about in March. Fast-track legislation. NAFTA is being reconsidered as we speak. For those of you who are interested in NAFTA issues, in international trade, and especially as they affect the environment, there's a lot of interesting things happening on that front right now, and this is a small side note. I'm hoping I'll be in D.C. in March to go to a meeting at EPA on that issue, and I'd be glad to plug some of y'all into that. Let me know. But trade legislation, fast-track authority, essentially is the same thing. Congress has handcuffed itself in advance. They've given the president the power to negotiate a package deal with his other trading partners, and then they basically have a limited window to vote it up or down. They can't say, I don't like this part, or I want special money for Massachusetts workers, and they can't say, I want a wall in this portion of the southern border. It's up or down. And then, once it's passed, it's president signs it. So it does meet still bicameral consideration. It still has presentment, but it's limited. Another example is base realignment. Military bases. How many of you are from San Antonio? You know what I'm talking about, Oscar? There's nothing less popular for a politician than closing a military base that a town relies on. So the process is currently set up, and I won't go into details, but it's ingenious in a craven way. They've set it up so that an independent commission decides whether to close the base, and then all they can do is vote against the commission's recommendation, but of course they always lose. Because the way it's set up, the majority of the House, or the legislature, almost always votes in favor of the commission. So essentially, it's presumed approval unless Congress affirmatively rejects it. I'm sorry, Glenn.
Oh, yeah, I just had a quick question about free bank. Did you say bathroom or bathroom deals?
Really?
There is a rich history in Congress dealing with bathrooms that I will not go into. Backroom.
Okay.
Yeah, no windows, cigar smoke, the whole bit. All right. Sorry, you completely derailed my train of thought.
So the base realignment, how is that like allowed basically after the ruling in Bowser? It seemed like they were similar in a sense.
Well, what way? That's a very interesting point. And by the way, thank you for volunteering to do Bowser. You picked up the first case of the semester. Alright, I'll put it to a vote. I normally only give swag once, but I have swag extra because I'm cleaning out my house and all sorts of weird stuff is popping up in the back of my closet. So would y'all be willing to give him swag for this?
Yeah.
Feel free to share what it is for those who can't see. Oh, come on. It's a pink cat. The sort of thing you see on a Saturday morning after you've had way too much on a Friday night. All right, I'm sorry. I distracted. You were about to give us a cogent and succinct insight into Bowser and how it might apply to base realignment.
I just thought it would apply to base realignment because power that they're designating to the comptroller was unconstitutional because it gave Congress basically executive power. Mm-hmm. And I kind of saw it as a similarity with that basically alignment commission because it's technically a
done a pretty good verdict. Quickly. I'm going to say something shocking. There is a possibility that there are some people in the class who have not read the case. So could you give us a very quick capsule summary of what voucher actually is?
Okay, so
I'm assuming you haven't done this in Professor Gray's class. You know what voucher meant?
No.
You may. Anyway, please keep going.
The Grand Remnant Commons Act sought to balance the budget by granting the comptroller power to enforce the budget limitations on the president. And Berger said Congress retained too much control of the comptroller, where basically it was a congressional agency. A congressional agency, and having the power to, I guess, limit the president's was, I don't know, I guess that appropriates the executive power, Congress power over the executive.
So, would you agree if I took what you said and mangled it a little bit?
Yeah.
Congress said the president must do what the comptroller told him to.
Yes.
Congress retained the power to fire the comptroller. Put the two together, that essentially gave Congress power over the expression of executive power.
Right.
If I fair enough, I didn't mean to mangle what you were saying, but
oh yeah, you just put it together a lot more.
No, I don't. It's been pointed out to me by people I love that I tend to jump in before people finish things, so stop me if I do that. But anyway, keep going. So how does that apply to the base realignment? Because that's a very interesting thought.
I just kind of saw a similarity because base realignment, we're basically saying that this commission designated by Congress can perform what would seem as an executive power check on it, and
the
council extension of congressional power over the
executive. So, with the Base Realignment Act, you're saying that the commission is equivalent to the comptroller. Hey, Congress is basically giving it the power to make a legislative decision. And the important thing here, I'm worried I'm muddying this for you guys. Congress has to accept what the commission says. The default is it's approved, unless it votes to override it. That's why, if you're representing someone in a base district, and you can vote no, but it's very, very rare, given that presumption, that you're going to overrule a package of base closure just because of your one little base in there. So here's the thing. How is the commission cabining the power of the executive? It was a separation of powers issue, about sure. Well, no, I'm just giving you a hard time. I'm not saying that there's a point there necessarily. You have to agree with me or not. Yes.
Was it originally?
And I'm out of swag. I should warn you.
Was it originally within Congress's like purview to close bases? Because I know like the executive control obviously controls. So the only way I can seem to make the jump is if the court felt like closing, like choosing which bases to close was incurring on the executive's power, but it was already within Congress's control to decide which bases to close. Even if they retained control over the commission that was closing bases, then they were still acting within their legislative sphere.
I'd like the subtlety to recast it little bit. Perhaps it's like saying the president strongly believes that this base should be up for national security purposes. Can Congress override the president's authority as commander-in-chief in that respect by closing a base? And I only have one suggested response, Guantanamo Bay. Obama tried to close that for 8 years, and Congress barred him from being able to do that, despite the fact that it was really on foreign soil, which would be even his foreign affairs power even more plenary. Now we're starting to get to rave territory, though, so I shouldn't be careful. All excellent thoughts. Any others?
Yes. Does this not like an involved question, but what does the president appoint the comptroller general?
Does the president what?
Appoint the comptroller
general. No, he's an employee of the Congress.
So
I agree. It would be interesting if the president appointed the comptroller, you might get a different answer. And there's a case later in the semester dealing with the board appointed to oversee accountants, where we have that same type of issue. Who appoints them?
Okay.
All right, so let's try and pull this all together here. Key thing is alternative lawmaking creates an answer to the roadblocks that we've already explored in our prior couple of classes. It creates other types of problems, though, for you as practitioners. So I want to leave you with one other thought and perhaps a little bit more elaboration, then we can talk about maybe an example to implement it. Why not just change these rules? We've talked about this to some extent a little bit, but I want to be really, really clear. What about the nuclear option? Can you, as an attorney, advocate to the Senate that you should just change the rules, either for your particular client or your particular matter, or just overall? Suspend filibuster for a particular piece of legislation, or just do away with the filibuster. Before you answer that one, let me give you a little bit of detail that's not in the book, but it might help sharpen what you're thinking on this list. The key thing about filibusters is that the Senate is actually governed by rules of proceedings. And they come in three varieties. Number one, standing rules. These are the rules that are always there. They're the ribs, the skeleton that the Senate process relies on. They've been in place since the first Senate session. Obviously modified with each session, and renewed with each session, but nonetheless, they are there. Number two, standing rules first. Number two, standing orders created ad hoc by the Senate. These are like the unanimous consent agreements we talked about to get a bill onto the floor of the Senate for consideration. So standing rules, standing orders, and then the last one is precedents. And that's a D-E-N-T-S, not N-C-E. Precedents, plural. Why do they matter? Those are essentially Senate interpretations of the standing rules and standing orders. They are not legislation. They are not rules that require a vote to change, that require a supermajority. Usually the Senate, if they want to change the rules, you're looking at least a two-thirds vote. Precedents only require a majority vote, 51. So as a result, you can actually use a precedent to change the way a rule, a standing rule, is interpreted. And that's what's been done with judicial appointees. Essentially, the president pro tem of the Senate, or the speaker, sorry, not speaker, good Lord, majority leader, the person holding the gavel will make a motion saying that we should interpret that this, the Senate rule governing filibusters will not require 60 votes for this particular class of candidates or legislation. At that point, the minority will object, of course, and say no. The majority's response is to then table the objection. That's 50 votes, 51 votes. That's enough. That's all you need. That's the precedent process that has now allowed Neil Gorsuch to sit on the Supreme Court, because they changed the precedent saying that the filibuster requirement still applied to Supreme Court nominees, even though it had previously in 2011 been taken off the table for all other judicial nominees. We've had two nuclear bombs dropped. Here's the question I'll pose for you to think about, given what I've just told you. The same thing can be done for legislation. There is now, on the betting markets, maybe, have y'all seen betting markets by chance? Not for sports events. They're basically idea markets. You can bet on whether something's going to happen to predict whether it will. There is now an active prediction market on whether the filibuster is going to be taken out completely for all legislation. There are a lot of people who think that it's just inevitable, given the polarization. You want to think about how the process described to you could also be applied to legislation and whether how likely it's going to be. So, tie all that together. What does it mean? It means that those alternatives I just described to you about omnibus, about using statutized rulemaking processes, about changing the rules, about pre-baking packages that are served in toto to the session, these are increasingly not going to be the alternative for high-profile deals, high-profile legislation. They're going to become the norm. So take your high school School Rock. Sorry, what's it? School Rock? I'm blanking out. What's the word? Schoolhouse Rock. It wasn't that long ago I was watching that with my kids. I should be careful. Anyway, those are going to be more and more common. And you need to be thinking about how you can try and get legislation onto those alternative paths if it serves your client's interest, and how you can manipulate them, he said cynically, to your client's advantage. Any questions before we start turning our eyes towards the next stage, which is how Congress can use its powers to control and muzzle the executive, which is a rather timely topic right now. Yes?
I'm triple
major,
so
this
becomes the norm.
Fascinating question. There are multiple federal statutes that require information to be made available to the public. So how many of you have done a FOIA request out of curiosity? Really, what context?
A couple years ago, for a small firm in Austin, requesting information from a certain agency, I forget which, in Kennedy County, southeast Texas, I guess, or Napa, like cool.
Yep, and did you get an answer?
I worked for them, submitted it, and then left. So maybe
what was it?
I asked him if he'd ever done a Freedom of Information Act request in FOIA. And so the reason I say it is, to get back to Michael's question, very, very good one. There are laws on the books that require the federal government to give you, and I'm stressing you individually, information you request. Any information, unless there's specific statutory exemptions. My environmental practicum class, we just got through doing a whole series of 13 information requests to different government agencies, and they have to respond to them. The statute requires, also, you probably did an open records act request for a Texas law.
It was open records.
So states have their own versions of it. Yeah. But notice, it only requires you to disclose information that the government has. If the government never creates it, there's no FOIA. That could be FOIA request you pay for. Does this sound like a small little loophole? I will simply point out, and again, I'm sorry to use environment, but this is where I live. EPA last year finished a major report on how to revamp the Superfund program. Of course, all of us academics, NGOs, outside practitioners all said, here's our FOIA request. Everything went to that report, and the response was, there is nothing. We intentionally did not write anything down. We did not have any emails. There are no transcripts. There is no audio. It just sprang from our brow like a thin. And there are a lot of people who just don't buy it. But if there's no information generated, there's no obligation to disclose it. And here, the legislative process, if there's no legislative history, there's no constitutional obligation to create it. All you have to do is meet the procedural steps for presentment and passage. So it hangs together. It's kind of insidious. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So in order to circumvent having audio or a transcript, I would assume we have to discuss future plans outside of, I'm assuming, the building or elsewhere. Correct?
That's correct, and you raised an important point, but keep going.
No, that was
no. There is a safety net, which is, you can't just move your meeting across the street at the picnic table and do the same thing and then say, well, it never happened in our building. Certain sessions where you have a majority of an agency, decision makers, are by definition an official meeting. There's an actual, for example, Open Meetings Act in Texas, which says that if you have a majority of decision makers, that is by definition an open meeting that must be posted in advance and people have a chance to attend and create a record. So what does that mean? It means that some agencies have only three commissioners. So what happens if one meets one in the hallway and starts talking? They can't talk to each other. Literally. They cannot discuss official business. Their poor general counsels, maybe folks like you, end up being shuttle diplomats, going back and forth between their offices saying, well, he said, she said. That's one way you can solve the problem, is if you have a meeting off campus, then it's considered to be a meeting that requires the maintenance of a record. The problem is usually those don't apply to legislative meetings, they apply to agency meetings. All right. Excellent questions. Any others? All right. Well, then let's turn the page. You should now have in your minds a legislative process package. What we're going to do now is take all those wheels and gears and use them against the other branch. You are a congressman. You want to cabin what the agency is doing. What tools do you have available to you do that? Well, the book goes through them. I just want to sort of give you a sense of which ones matter and how you can use them. So jump in, ask questions anytime. I do not want to monologue you on this, but there are some distinctions that are important. The book spends a fair amount of time on things that I hope you already knew before you even applied to law school, which is basically the bones of the constitutional process, the separation of powers, the different roles of the different branches, the way that that power is spread, not only by the three articles, but also buried in little trap doors in each individual article. So you may have judicial constraints in Article 1. You may have executive constraints in Article 2. The key thing here is that you don't, for this class, need to be able to pull out your pocket constitution. Would you wave that to everybody? Actually, oh, do you still have it? And I know I gave out one last week. I just want to let everyone know, you can get your own pocket copies of constitutions. Just go online and do a free pocket constitution. You'll find that there's a college that does that. Also, Google will sell you one for a buck. I don't know why, but nonetheless. So, point being here is I'm sorry.
I think you should ask for a message, bro.
Yeah, Billy's got some new ones.
Yeah,
I have a box.
Oh, really?
Jason has some.
Do they
get
the professors?
No, I mean, you know the rep in like OQ2.
What's that one?
Yeah, and it has the articles and the cause and stuff all separated out.
You didn't have it there when.
We should write our Congress on
that.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
I tried to get one from Lexus, but they didn't have one.
Yeah, they didn't have any. You might have to
get everything. The key thing is, please get your own copies of the constitutions. I'm not going to ask you what Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 says. All right? I may ask you, for example, about certain important constraints on power that have substantive consequences, but I'm assuming most of you will know them anyway from your common law classes or from prior life in general. I'm assuming you know what a bill of attainder is or ex post facto laws. I'm assuming you don't know the incompatibility clause, which is a delicious little clause.
Delicious.
It is. But it's not something that's likely to affect your daily practice, so I won't, it's not what I'm going to ding you on. But the key thing here is that let's look a little bit past that. I'm going to assume you have the constitutional vocabulary here, although I'm always happy to stop and answer and talk about questions related to it. Let's talk about other tools of legislative process that can be used to control and turn the executive into the legislative. There's all sorts of evaluated terms there. Pet, zombie, bitch, whatever. Anyway. So what can you do? Well, first of all, if you want the agency to do exactly what you want it to do, the first and most obvious step, and I say this with bitter, bitter experience, is you tell them. You tell them an excruciating, fine point, incredibly picayune detail. So, for certain areas, you will find federal statutes are designed expressly to give incredibly detailed instruction to the agencies on what exactly they can and cannot do. I'm not kidding you. There is, for example, environmental legislation which dictates how thick plastic liners have to be at the bottom of landfills by congressional decree. That's one way to use legislative power to control the executive. I will suggest to you it tends to arise in one certain context. The legislative branch doesn't trust the executive. They just don't trust them. That has happened, for example, the legislation I just told you about arose during the Reagan administration, when there was a lot of concern about sweetheart deals between the EPA management at the time and companies that were doing cleanups. So Congress said, no way. This is what we think. So, detailed legislation, number one. Number two, this was fun because it's happening as we speak. It may be done by now, though. Oversight hearings. I know some of you have legislative backgrounds, so I just can't resist asking. How many of you have seen oversight hearings before? Really? In what context?
The Texas Senate.
Was it brutal?
Huh?
Was it brutal?
Yeah, it was really boring. All we were talking about, like, the Sunset Commission and all this stuff, and so they'd like, okay, go do this, and you just go through this big folder, and it was really boring.
Yeah. That, I admit, that is a risk. I meant brutal in the sense of that they were hammering on the poor guy.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. And, like, they also, I also sat in on a lot of, like, budget hearings, and a lot of agencies would have to sit there and go, oh, yeah, we spent this money on this, and they're like, that's how you're using the money?
Really, like, I'm shocked that gambling's taking place in this establishment. Well, today, the fun, and this literally just wrapped up. I'm sorry we could have done this at the beginning class. I tried to put up so you could at least see it.
Kathy, you rejected a request from North
for the first time in this entire administration, Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, is going before the Senate for an oversight here. Yeah, this is Senator Carper, who just hammered it. It's just brutal.
Pollution control. Last week, you issued a memorandum to allow industry to increase air emissions of toxic chemicals like arsenic, like mercury, like lead, and impacting the health of millions of people in further working states dealing with cross-state pollution. Later on, we'll get to some questions. They're not yes or no questions. I have a limited amount of time. I'm going to start off with a series of yes or no questions. To answer them yes or no, if you will, please, later on you'll have a chance.
Side note, when everyone says yes or no question,
so off,
put your hands over your head.
It's
a bad sign.
EPA do an analysis of the health effects of last week's decision, including analysis of the potential increased cancer risk. Did you?
Are you referring to the once in, always in decision, the policy decision from last week, Senator?
Yep.
Yes, that was a policy decision we have authority to make in the interpretation of statute.
Yes or no?
I'll save you some pain. He goes back and forth. He never says no. But hearings like this play an incredibly important role because exactly their purpose. You put Pruitt in the spotlight or whatever agency. I don't mean to pick on this administration or this particular administrator, but their purpose is to essentially call them to account. You will usually have favorable questions from the majority. There are some incredible softballs early in this hearing from the chair of the committee. But Carper at one point literally said, you're misrepresenting what the Obama administration accomplished. Stop it. In that tone, in that voice. You probably all saw Senator Booker shouting passionately inveighing against one of the witnesses last week as well. So oversight hearings are very important. They have a large amount of theater, but they signpost very clearly what the Congress cares about. It signals it directly to the agency, and it gives a forum for them to ask questions, both oral and written. He also had to provide written answers to questions in advance as well. So that's detailed legislation, oversight hearings. Number three, don't let him sit in the chair. Refuse to appoint nominees. This is fairly straightforward and obvious. This administration's had more trouble than others in getting people nominated in the first place, but getting them approved is even more problematic. For those of you who are interested, since time is growing short, I'll simply say the name, Kathleen Hartnett White. If you have a chance, if you want something amusing, Google her. I like Kathleen. She was actually a former chair of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality in Texas for quite a while. And she's, I think, has the best wishes in her heart. But she's also taken some very strong positions on the lack of global climate change and other issues that have commanded the scientific majority opinion. And they actually, it was a close call whether or not she was going to be nominated last year. And her nomination died when the session closed. So President Trump has re-nominated her, and she's getting ready to be reconfirmed again after an excruciating nomination hearing last year. So take a look. If you'd like, we might even have a popcorn party to watch that one because it's going to be highly entertaining. And you can probably take some lessons from it. Mike?
Under the oversight section, they talk about putting directives in the legislative history. That doesn't happen when you're writing the legislation, right? You can't do it afterwards.
And that's why you tend not to see it. unless electricity be reauthorized, which has a certain period of operation, like 5 years, but where you really see it, and that's sort of the next one. Thank you. It's a wonderful segue. I promise it was not a planted question. The other oversight mechanism is appropriations. Congress, like many state legislatures as well, is weird. There's a whole separate dimension of additional parallel lawmaking that must occur where a law actually takes effect. You can pass the substantive statute, but then you now have to pass a separate appropriations bill to give it the money to actually do anything. Usually, Congress members are different on the different groups that are passing them, and appropriations legislation is tailor-made for exactly what you're talking about. You will see directions in the legislation itself as to how each dollar shall be spent. You will see additional directions in the documents, such as committee reports accompanying it, directly telling the agency how to spend and not spend its money. And you will also see a whole constellation of informal communications that do the same thing. You can actually see legislation that has what's called a defunding rider, which specifies that this particular program will not receive a dime. It's a sniper shot in legislation. It kills it dead. And it sounds exotic and ridiculous. This exact mechanism was used to basically shut down any type of climate change work by EPA during the George W. Bush administration. Congress basically denied any funding to EPA for any kind of work on climate change. They had to shut down the office or relabel it. Yes?
What did you say that was called?
Defunding. So, questions so far? Anything? A few things about appropriations. I'm sorry, Oscar, this is on. Okay. A few other things to add about appropriations because it's enormously important. Number one, appropriations by House rules. Remember that House does appropriations. House rules typically say they will not do substantive legislation. They're not going to relitigate the fight that created the legislation in the first place. They're just arguing about what money it gets. Now, that's not hard and fast. The House can, by special rule, say that they are allowing the appropriations process to reconsider the merits, but usually that is not the case. And second, you can put it this way. House appropriations directives, you need to remember, are usually time limited. Appropriations bills typically, with rare exception, tend to have to get passed every year or every other year. So frequently what you'll see is that directions interpretation, which go with a bill, die with that bill when the new one's passed. So I've seen the same provisions interpreted completely opposite ways over multiple years dealing with large-scale dam projects in the Army Corps of Engineers. So that's just part of the way, that's one of the strengths, one of the weaknesses of the appropriation process. You may say, well, why would the agency pay attention to that? When the agency controls your money, they get enormous attention from the agencies. They will do, oftentimes to the letter, what a small little line in appropriations bill committee report dictates them to do. It's a very powerful tool. Okay, so any questions so far? All right, then last big tool, and that is just design the problem away. You want to control an agency, instead of constantly having your hands in the wheel and passing appropriations bills or having oversight hearings or fighting over who gets to run it, design the agency from the ground up in a way so it can only do what you want it to do. And we will talk about this more later this semester, and you may already be familiar with it, but there are fundamental choices Congress can make in what type of agency it is and how it's run that will essentially shape what it can do without oversight. So for example, going back to our first example of the semester, the Civil Rights Act created the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Congress specifically did something rather unusual. They defanged the commission. They yanked out its ability to pass rules. It cannot pass legislative regulations. That's very rare. But more importantly, Congress can also do the opposite and empower a committee by insulating it from influence. And here, the most important thing here is we're going to talk about the difference between executive agencies and independent agencies. Essentially, an independent agency can have things such as multiple commissioners with staggered terms, appointed from both sides of the aisle that has funding mandates that do not coincide with the period of an administration, so that they have built into them an independent voice. And it makes a big difference. For those of you who track this, our former governor, Perry, who is now, surprisingly, the Department of Energy Administrator, Secretary Perry, as you may all know, proposed a package that effectively would have created a rule to subsidize coal power generation, because coal power was resilient. It also would have funded nuclear energy. The idea is that if you had a storm, a major weather event, a freeze, wind shuts down, solar's unreliable, gas can't be counted on, but you can have 90 days of stockpiled energy sitting in a coal-powered power plant. He actually used an arcane provision of the Energy Act to propose it directly as a rule, and then it got relayed to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. Here's where the structure mattered. FERC is independent. Even though most of the commissioners in FERC have been appointed by President Trump, it is given a mandate to exercise its judgment without orienting itself to the political dictates of the executive branch. They turned down their boss. FERC's within DOE. They essentially told Secretary Perry, and I'm not exaggerating too much, this idea makes no sense. And they killed it. But they did it diplomatically. They said they're going to reconsider this and consider a rule that might make sense. But Perry's proposal is DAD. That's because of the way the agency is designed. And so those kind of constraints really matter. Okay, so with that, we are close to the end of class. Any questions about? But wait, you signed the opt-out list for today. You don't have to ask any questions. Yeah. Okay, go for it.
Our agency is usually created with some kind of law, or are they created independently by the Congress itself?
Both. For example, there have been agencies created after the existence of the law, but like the Securities Exchange Commission came about the same time largely as the creating organization of the underlying laws themselves. EPA was created by executive order long after the original acts were passed. So it's no requirement that it has to, but you tend to see it that way. Good question. Any others? All right, then I actually forgot to give you, I'm sorry, Oscar, go ahead. I want to make sure I understand your question. That were you asking about to what extent the appropriations process is limited? And I think I said that they usually don't get to the substance. I also said that usually it's only for the term of the funding bill, so it only lasts a couple of years typically. And I also said that, I think that may be that. I'm not sure. Anything else? Excellent. Okay. I forgot to say, how many of you are interested potentially? I'm sorry, I'll be right back with you. How many are interested in doing legislative stuff at some point, or even right now? I just want to let you know the American Bar Association actually does legislative advocacy. And just give you an example, this is a resolution. I will not put on the website because it's actively being presented to legislators as I speak, but it is a resolution by the ABA to change the law governing the ability for private citizen suits under statutes. I'm sure you guys, you probably talked about Court v. Ash already in your other classes. Basically, there's a presumption that Congress does not mean to give private rights of action unless they specifically say so. And this is a proposal to change that, in particular with Section 1983, please. I thought you'd just like to see how this gets done. This is the resolution that passed the House of Delegates of the American Bar Association and the supporting memorandum as to why it makes sense. And if you're interested in this sort of thing, let me know, and we can try and see if we can get you plugged into it. This probably will take place, my guess is not until the next session. All right. With that, I think I'm getting close to what I wanted to talk with about you today, unless you have other questions or thoughts or suggestions or ideas. Drew, I'm sorry, I forgot to come back to you.
My question relates to the consumer financial protection.
Sarah?
Yes.
And as Bob will probably know, some of the rules that were set to go into effect, I think in 2019 or so, in fact, have been sort of, I think they use the Elizabeth Congressional Review Act that they use to basically take those rules away, or to remove them, to prevent them from going into effect.
Absolutely. Two things, because you raised a whole other issue as well. There, talking about statutized processes, the Congressional Review Act is another example of a statute where Congress has foreclosed the use of filibusters to kill rules. And we'll talk about that later in the semester, but I want to make sure Drew's point was captured. But second, there's also a question as to who gets to put the person in charge, who gets to appoint the leader of the agency. For those of you who are interested, there is actually a lawsuit taking place right now. Okay, they're not going to let me do it. I'll try and get this printed out for you. The Consumer Finance Protection Board currently is enmeshed in a lawsuit because the outgoing leader appointed his deputy to run the agency when he went to become run for governor of Ohio. Guess what? President Trump said, I don't care. I'm appointing my man to that spot. So now Secretary Mulvaney is also doing double duty heading that agency. It's right now before the D.C. District Court as to who gets to run the agency. So we may actually in real time get to test some of the things we're talking about in class this week. So great point. Thank you for raising it. Okay. Any others? Then you're free. Go have a great lunch. We'll see you on Thursday. Don't forget the literary clips. Oh, by the way, there are a few folks who didn't show up on the seating chart, but they've been absent today that you got filled in. So if you want to be included, I'd leave it up here for you. And there we get to sign it.
The reintroduction of legislative vetoes as a sixth sort of check, is that something that we're just tucking in with the design of?
I'll be honest, I'm freeloading off of this.
Oh, okay.
Assuming you guys are talking about product.
Oh, cool.
I'm not going to ask you to go into detail with it. But I do things, I will just write it in the
kitchen,
that's possible.
Okay.
Yeah.